Hi, and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and we have got a dynamic hour for you. Now, before we go to our guest today, I want to give out our toll-free telephone numbers where later on in the hour you'll be able to call in. For the USA, 877-876-5227, or for our Canada, 888-810-8322, and we also have a direct line of 530-876-9146. Again, telephone lines will be open later on in the show. I do want to welcome to our radio waves Michael Ball, because he has really done something that I don't think many people consider, and that is put together a book giving you information about how you're too smart for this, beating the 100 big lies about your first job. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Donna.
It's a pleasure. Now, where are you located, Michael?
I'm actually in Los Angeles.
You're in L.A. Yeah. Well, that is a hub of activity, if ever there was one.
Indeed.
And it is just such a dynamic area to be in Southern California. Now, I want my listeners to know a little bit about you. You're the founder and CEO of Career Freshman Company. It's an entry-level training authority to Fortune 1000. As a management consultant, you have worked with many different areas of industry, and that includes all kinds of brand name companies, and you've really been into training, and it's been so effective that there's a number of colleges and various educational departments that have decided they want to bring this on. Michael, tell us how you got started with all of this and why this kind of training is so important, because that's what motivated you to do the book, isn't it?
No, that's exactly right. I got started in it, quite candidly, the hard way, coming from making pretty much all the mistakes that I talk about in the book, and really just realizing, kind of going through and saying, hey, you know, college didn't prepare me for any of this. And all like the real practical stuff, I found myself learning the hard way. And I thought, well, you know, I can't be alone. And so, I started just kind of jotting the thoughts down. And I didn't really have any intention to write a book. And suddenly it got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And then before you knew it, you know, we had something. So one thing kind of led to the next.
Well, it's really interesting. And I'm going to take some material right off the back of your book, because
yeah.
I think this states something very well. You've just spent $100,000, possibly more, on a college degree to make photocopies, and your manager won't even be happy with them. And life at the entry level isn't about what school you graduated from or even who you know. I can remember someone who had been in business for years, graduated from some prestigious university, Stanford or whatever, had some kind of a business degree. And he said to me, you can have the finest of diplomas, but very few people ever check what school you graduated from. Why is that?
Well, certainly the brand name kind of counts, you know, to some degree or the other. But I think that the big point here is that when it almost is incidental. Now they'll look at the school you went to, but it's incidental that whatever GPA you had or whatever, you know, degree, whatever college name is on the degree you have. At the entry level, you start out on the bottom, and that's for a few reasons, not the least of which is economic, in that the companies, you know, they're bringing you on at a level where it doesn't make sense for a manager, you know, financially speaking, it doesn't make sense for a manager to kind of be doing the stapling and the filing and the formatting, mm-hmm. and all that sort of work. So it's really incumbent upon the newbies to come in and really step up and embrace it, no matter how smart they are. And that's kind of where the title of the book came from, is that, yeah, you are too smart for the work you're doing, but it's really beside the point at the entry level.
Boy, I couldn't agree with you more. And I've encountered so many people that when they get out of college, they say, well, wait a minute, where's my $120,000 a year job?
Yeah.
I mean, excuse me, do you know what I did? Do you know how much money I've invested in this education? And this is supposed to do it for me. What went wrong? And I talked to a young man who was driving a van shuttling from a hotel to an airport.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, how do you feel about that? He said, it doesn't make me too happy to be what I'm doing. But if I don't get my education, I'm not even going to be looked at.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have to. It's that struggle to the top of the college ladder, and then you get knocked on your butt right back down. But but that's the way the system is built. And I've been pretty vocal and openly critical of the liberal arts system, and I think it has its good points and its bad points. I mean, I think we all need to be versed in, you know, Plato and Shakespeare and sociology and all the rest of it, but there is decidedly a lack of focus on the real practical, usable stuff: how to manage a manager, how to get on in a group, how to build a personal brand, how to negotiate for a raise, and doing performance reviews, and all these things that really become life in the day in and day out. We're just really not prepared for.
Yes. Now, I love one of your quotes from Jefferson's Children. Who are you fooling? Parents and students often harbor the exclusive illusion that college is about preparing oneself for the practical business of life.
Yet, so many students really think that coming out of school, they are prepared. They say, listen, I took a class, and even for the kids who end up doing something that they actually studied for, like the accountants and the engineers.
Mm-hmm.
Even then, yeah, you may have at least the entry level or the fundamentals of what you're going to be doing squared away professionally. But really, you know, the work, most newbies don't struggle with the work, usually because it's, you know, far below their level of competence. But even when the work is more challenging, the successful completion of the work itself isn't the issue. It's all the politics and all the stuff that comes part and parcel with actually doing that work.
Oh, so true. Now, I want to start off with the very first chapter in your book.
Yes.
Actually, it's actually lie number one. You're going to love your first couple of jobs.
Yes.
Yes, like the shuttle driver I talked with.
Yes.
Okay, tell us about this.
Well, okay, so and companies here are really, you know, I'm back on campus pretty frequently, and I'm talking to a lot of kids, and it still happens, is companies will come on campus, and they'll send a bunch of, you know, over-caffeinated company reps and the big, flashy multimedia presentations. They put on a whole big dog and pony show talking about how this is going to be, you know, so exciting and fun and glamorous, and you're going to have this great travel and work with all these great people, and it's just going to be amazing, and this is the next step. And then you get there, and it's, you know, you get dumped in a cube, and you're, you know, given an Excel spreadsheet and says, here, do it. And then you're looking around, I show up to the right place today. So it's really a bait and switch that happens. Yet professors and parents are almost just as guilty, because they're really puffing it up. You know, be up professors saying, oh, you know, you're going to leave and you're going to graduate and you go take on the world and you're going to be a manager by 30 and, you know, making $100,000 and all the rest of it. And parents, you know, are gushing and coddling and, you know, doing all the rest of it. No one's really sitting them down and actually having that conversation about what is the case.
That's true. Now, let's go to lie number six. Your college degree actually means something. Now, this is a toughie. This is a toughie.
It's a big toughie, and it's a huge, huge ego problem in that everyone has one nowadays, or, you know, more or less, at least, you know, in the workplace, kind of the companies that most newbies go to, it's a de facto, it's a standard.
Mm-hmm.
It's a minimal denominator for entry. So, yet when newbies are trying to differentiate themselves and justify why they should be given this assignment or be on this project team, what do they have to point to? They certainly don't have a career track record, so they end up saying, well, you know, don't you know I graduated from Stanford or Harvard or UCLA or Berkeley or, you know, wherever else it is. But quite candidly, once you're in the door, and speaking to the earlier point, it's incidental. It doesn't matter really where you graduated from. If people don't like you, if you're not working well, if you're walking in, your head's big enough to have its own weather system. Listen, you're not going to get staffed on the projects you want. Yet you have nothing else behind you from a credibility standpoint. So it's a big issue, and it really you can only fix it with time and just knocking out the stuff that you're given.
I have an attitude, and I think that those that have been around the block a few times and are wise in their maturing years is pretty much the same, and that is you have to pay your dues. You have to be willing to do the grunt work as well as aspiring for the CEO positioning if that's what you want. You need to know and experience a lot of things. You may not be good at everything, but you need to have an understanding of it. And experience is one of the best ways to do it. Now, for those of you who are just tuning in to the program, who we are talking with is Michael Ball, and he is the author of a book called You're Too Smart for This, Beating the 100 Big Lies About Your First Job. Now, if it sounds sort of defeating, it's like, oh, groan, Donna, this just doesn't make me feel too good. If you're a person that's going to college and you're hearing us discuss these different perspectives, don't think that it's not valuable that you're getting that degree anymore. You need to have that degree, just like we were saying. You need to have that degree so that you're going to be seen as someone who is willing to make an investment in themselves. Basically, that's often what's determined. And a master's degree, lots of companies won't even talk to you until you have one. So here you are with all of this stuff. And what Michael wants to do is bring out the understanding for you about really dealing with the realities of life. Intelligent, line number 10, intelligence makes up for experience. Not true.
Not.
Big N-O-T-T-R-U-E.
Absolutely, and that was certainly one of my biggest problems. I thought, hey, I'm a smart guy, I can figure it out. Not the case. And it's an old saw, but newbies don't realize. They think, well, hey, listen, I was smart enough to, fool my professors and, plagiarize these, papers and get old exams. And I found a way to work the system, and, I got the grades I needed to get, and here I am.
Mm-hmm.
I can figure it out. The biggest gap in something that you can only learn with time is that experience is absolutely the best predictor of success. You have to live through it and pay attention to what's going on to really understand, here's how I approach this kind of situation or dealing with this kind of person or getting through this kind of project. And you, unfortunately, as the expression goes, experience doesn't come until after you need it. So it's kind of the catch-22, but it's the position newbies are in.
You have a wonderful example about doctors relative to experience, and it was an example by Robert E. Kelly, a professor at Carnegie Mellon University's Graduate School of Industrial Administration, and he just had a pretty significant comment. Share that with us.
Yeah, so he's a professor I've been following for some years, but he likens it to doctors in the ER. And kind of going back to our example, it doesn't matter if you graduated from Harvard or Stanford. The way that the doctors work is, over time, they see patients and they build up sort of this mental case history. So they learn to identify the kinds of symptoms and so on that go together. So when a patient comes in, they can look at them and say, I've seen this kind of thing before. Let's the signs point this way, and you can kind of learn which treatments are going to work better. Which is why I kind of make the joke in the book. I said, forget the young hotshot with the top 1% MCAT score. I'm going to take the old guy.
And that's very true. That I think, there's so many different levels to this, and much of what you have in your book, You're Too Smart for This, Beating the 100 Big Lies About Your First Job, can even be applied when someone's re-entering a workforce after being out for a while.
Yeah, and that's actually a really great point. The principles, while it's specifically written for new college graduates, And I've been told this by a number of people, it really scales across, you know, the generation. So even, you know, second, third, fourth year, and even second, third, and fourth career, there's still nuggets that you can pull out of it. And just kind of general life principles and working principles, that it's a great refresher for, you know, for anyone who's maybe been out for a little while and wants a kind of that gut level sense of what's happening and how do I approach it.
You cover another lie. It's lie number 19. You can handle it without a mentor.
Yes, this is one of my biggest pieces of advice, is that the best way to get through any new place is with a tour guide. You want that, so you're essentially buying that experience or you know, requisitioning that experience of someone else, someone who's been there, someone who's seen it, and usually mentors. I mean, some companies have kind of a mandatory mentorship program where
mm-hmm.
where seniors are assigned, and those are a mixed bag. I mean, certain people, you know, they want to do it and they'll do a good job, and other people, it's sort of a mentor name. Regardless, I advise newbies to definitely seek out someone early on who a senior, someone who's been there for a few years, or at least a couple of years, and really has a sense of what's going on, and then to lean on them for their daily questions and you know, things that they don't want to constantly be bugging their manager about. You can hit up your senior and as a mentor and really get that information you need.
You talk also, and this is line number 22. Networks are for more established professionals.
Not so. You need to be building your network from day one. You should be collecting those cards, and you know, I even keep a spreadsheet of everyone, sort of all the people in my network, and I keep, you know, I track. Okay, here's when I last saw them or talked to them, and here's when we're due to follow up next, and here's, you know, send them a card at the holidays and so on, and really very actively maintaining that network, because as newbies come to learn the hard way, and not only does it not matter how smart you are, the more important thing, and this is an even older saw, is who you know. It's really all about the connections, and one tends to lead you to the next. So I advocate newbies to start from day one, to start building that network and getting in tight with the people who are going to get them where they need to go.
Now, we covered this a little bit, and it's line number 33. You're one of a kind to the company. It sort of reminds me of the recruiting process, but touch on this for a moment.
Yeah, it does have to do with the recruiting process, in that you know, companies make it sound like, oh, you know, we want you, and you're the best one on this campus, and, you know, this spot's going to be perfect for you. And, okay, that's true to some degree. But you know, the truth of the matter is that you're coming in, you know, colleges are like Walmart to companies. You know, it's an everyday low prize. You just pick who you want, toss them in the basket. And if it doesn't work out, it's pretty low risk to move on. So what I encourage newbies to do is, you have the same background, the same experience. You're more or less doing the same thing as everyone else. So you really need to build this personal brand, or some identify a way that you can differentiate yourself and really stand out. So, for instance, if looking around your team, and I say really, you know, really study the team, the department, figure out, you know, where the holes are, and then you need to figure out what your skills are and how you can fill that gap. So it's really about defining yourself and getting known for an important kind of business skill set or opportunity, and then making sure that gets broadcast across the organization. Hey, when I need such and such done, this is who I'm going to turn to.
Lie number 29, you can lie, cheat, and steal like in college. Now, that is not too positive a statement about college. However, be that as it may, your first sentence under lie number 29, you can lie, cheat, and steal like in college, as far as ethics go, college is for students what prison is for criminals. You only get better at being bad.
Yeah. No. The caveat here is that's it's not the case for everyone, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
But it's it's definitely the case for, you know, a substantial minority of students. And even if you're not outright stealing or plagiarizing or cheating or so on, you know, there's definitely, it's a flavors of it. It's more like gaming the system and figuring out the strategic corner that you can cut and kind of getting away with stuff and, you know, cramming things in the night before and just really all the tricks you pull, learning when you can show up to class, what kind of questions the professor tends to ask, that sort of thing. And I bring it up as a point of contrast for the entry level in that you can't really get away with that stuff anymore. Certainly you want to do the things that are going to help make your job easier and go faster, but in terms of, you know, fudging an expense report or anything, you know, anything in that nature, it really has consequences now. It's a big deal, especially if you get caught. So, you know, I said, hey, listen, you had fun and you got lucky. You made it where you are now. And so the game, for all intents and purposes, is over, and you need to learn the rules of the new game now.
Line number 36, people already know what you can do for them. That was interesting to me, because when we're hired in a job,
yeah,
we're assuming, and I think of one person that I'm very aware of who just recently I was chatting with, who is in a major corporation and is having tremendous conflicts. This is an extremely talented individual, mm-hmm. and they are accustomed to being very much self-motivated.
Yes.
They're the performer, and yet they're just having a devil of a time. And they think that their boss should, I mean, they're absolutely the boss hired them. They know what they can do, but they don't.
They don't. And you bring up a really great point. And this is actually a conversation I've been having as of late with a few of the people who I consult for. And that's the issue of fit. And it's so much about you can be, you know, one of the smartest, most talented and capable people in the world, but if you're not in the environment that is going to leverage your best skills or allow you to really shine the way that you're capable of shining, you are going to run into that difficulty and people not really recognizing, you know, everything that the value you have to offer and everything that you can do. So it's really incumbent upon you, the new worker, to first of all, before you even take a job, to really understand what you're good at or what you think you at least think you might be good at or what you might like or where you might succeed. And then, you know, you get the gig and then you see if it's a fit for you. But from there, once you're actually in the door, the onus is on you to communicate those types of things to your manager, so such that insofar as there is flexibility in the type of work that you're doing, or at least on, you know, on some level, you know, let's say you have a certain amount of defined work, but maybe there's, you know, 30-40% of what you do that allows some flexibility, work with your manager to really understand, hey, listen, this is what I'm interested in, this is really where I want to grow into, is there any opportunities for me to do this kind of work? And I think a dialogue needs to be open. It has to be a very active and flexible conversation.
You have a real good section on lies, damn lies, and office politics. And I love this quote by cosmetic heiress Elizabeth Arden. And she was talking to her husband. She said, dear, never forget one little point. It's my business. You just work here.
Yeah.
And I would have thought, I went, whoa.
That's really how she talked.
I mean, that was one tough lady. Politics.
She was.
Oh, my gracious. I don't know of any working environment where there isn't some kind of politics. Define politics.
There's no such thing as any office place or really, I mean, any relationship, anything you deal. There's an element of politics that's always involved. And my biggest advice to newbies is stay out of it as much as humanly possible. You want to be that easygoing one who everyone gets along with, everyone likes. They know they can work with you. They know you get stuff done. They don't have to worry about you. You know, what are they saying when I'm not there? All this sort of thing. You just want to be that easy, nonpartisan one. Now, granted, I'm hesitating a bit because once you do start moving up in rank, yeah, I mean, that's naturally, by definition, it's a political endeavor. But even at that, you just want to stay as open with people as possible, and really try to avoid all those back office dealings.
Yes, and the lunch office chit-chats, or lunchroom chit-chats, I should say.
Yeah.
And various things that can get you stuck. There's one thing that happens, and once you get into whatever might be described as a little clique,
yes,
then your particular parameters are really going to shrink like nobody's business. So like you said, being impartial is very important. You have so many different things you address. Line number 52, colleagues don't influence promotion. Line number 54, the job has to exist for you to get it. I mean, you address so many different issues here. How does politics get into that?
Well, that's why the section is so big. You know, politics influences so many areas of the work. But to one of the ones you address, colleagues don't influence promotions, and that's actually one I'm in talking about that whole moving on and moving forward type of element. In that, a lot of people think, well, listen, if I just buckle down, nose to the grindstone, do my work, do a good job, I'm going to get promoted. And regrettably, that's not necessarily the case. If you happen to rub a senior, someone with some influence, the wrong way, not the least of whom being your manager, chances are you're not going to move on and move up how you intended. So it's critical that newbies pay very, very close attention, and as we sort of alluded to before, is that you maintain those relationships very carefully. You understand how things are going. You have a constant feedback loop going, such that you're always on top of, okay, this is an issue, okay, this issue's been resolved, or I'm getting a bad vibe from this person, and that you're constantly monitoring what's happening, such that when you're sitting down in that chair and here's performance review time, you're going to get that, you're talking about that promotion, that nothing's going to take you by surprise.
Well, as you can tell, there is so much in this book, and there are 100 big lies, good information here, that whether this is your first job when you're coming out of college, or it's a first job after not working for a long time and you want to sort of get reoriented into the working world of reality, well, this is a book that I think is a must-have, and I think it should go into every college student's backpack and a must-read. They should be tested on this. You're Too Smart for This, Beating the 100 Big Lies About Your First Job. Michael Ball is my guest. Michael, what's your website? If people would like to find out more about what you offer and the courses you teach and so on and so forth.
Yes, indeed. The site is careerfreshman.com.
Careerfreshman.com.
That's right. And, all the contact information is there. And everyone, please feel free to get in touch. I'm happy just to answer questions or business or otherwise. We'd just love to get the conversation going.
Yes, and there's just so much fun stuff in here. I mean, absolutely wonderful things, and we just don't have enough time to go through all of it. And there's a couple of them I wish I'd had time to share because they're just really fun. Michael Ball is my guest. You're Too Smart for This, Beating the 100 Big Lies About Your First Job. His website is careerfreshman.com. Michael, in closing, is there anything special that you would like to share with my listeners?
Yes, the book is it's a ton of fun to read. I've been told that it's as much fun as I had writing it, and whether it's a gift for the kids or you're buying it yourself, it's more than just a job book. There's really life lessons in there that I think everyone can benefit from. So I really encourage you to check it out.
Thank you, Michael. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break for a moment. Let me repeat Michael's website, Michael Ball, careerfreshman.com. Careerfreshman.com. The title of the book is You're Too Smart for This, Beating the 100 Big Lies About Your First Job. It's a good publication for any age. If you're wanting to get into the working world, it is a must read. Donna Sebo here, and we'll be taking a break. We'll be back in just a moment. Again, Michael Ball, thank you so much for being my guest. I wish you tremendous success in all of your endeavors.
Thanks so much for having me, Donna.
It's been a pleasure. We'll be back in just a few seconds, so don't you go away. This is Donna Sebo, and we've got more good things to share. Hi, this is Donna Siebel, and this is our Hour of Mind Power, and including that, you have an opportunity to check in with me if you'd like. I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. 877-876-5227 is our call-in number for here in the U.S., 877-876-5227. If you're in Canada and you'd like to call in and chat with me for a moment, 888-810-8322. That's 888-810-8322. And then we have a direct line for any place else at 530-876-9146. That's 530-876-9146. And I do want to remind those of you that are listening, if you are in Alaska, if you are in Anchorage, Fairbanks, anywhere in Alaska, I'm going to be up in Alaska on the 18th, and I will be specifically in Fairbanks and Anchorage doing some appearance time there. Also, I'm going to be in New York City, so people can reach me for in-person or telephone consultations, whatever you would like to do. But call my office if you would like some more information about that. And also, we have got our newsletter up online, and you're welcome to go to DelphiInternational.com and drop in there and pick up on the newsletter, and you'll find out all about my schedule and the various things that are going on. Also, I've got a wonderful broadcast in Boston that's going to be occurring on the 30th. So the time and the information, all of that is there on the newsletter. So share it with your friends. Well, I have a number of different items that I just wanted to share with you today, and I thought, wow, what am I going to start with? Which one? There's so many good things. And one of them is a story about a horse. And this was sent to me by Linda and Alan, and it's a story about a horse, Shirley Warnick. This is her throwaway horse. And Alan and Linda, we're going to be talking with them in one of our future shows. They have got so many wonderful, wonderful stories that they share with people all over the world through their email newsletter. And it's always delightful to have them on the program because they come out with such wonderful, wonderful books. Yeah, but this story really touched my heart and my mind because there are so many animals in the world that are just abandoned. They are left and nobody's ever going to claim them, and here in this country there are many, many. In the U.S. there's many animals that are euthanized because nobody wants them and there's no place to keep them or put them. Well, this is a story about Shirley and her throwaway horse, and she wasn't looking for another horse. She already had three. However, she said she'd learned a long time ago that when animals were brought into your environment, it came in for a reason. And this shaggy little red mare happened to step off of a trailer, and this was among a bunch of other horses that were up for a real quick sale. And she said this horse was 18 years old, was very, very much undernourished, and they had just tried to sell her over and over and over again. When they did sell her, whoever had her just sort of wore her out. And at 18 years of age, she was pretty tired. Now, many horses can live to be in their 30s if they have the right kind of environment. Sometimes they can reach 40, but in general, they can live until their 30s unless they have a real tough time. So here she is at 18, and she's just really in bad shape. So Shirley feels like she needs to take her. And she watched her, and she just was trying to figure out, what am I going to do with this? And she took her on, and she said she had had her for a little while, and she observed her, and she noticed that she was incredibly beautiful. She said, this is an animal that was just a shadow of a former self at 18 years of age, and in her care, in Shirley's care, she found that she just was responding beautifully. Well, she just said, this is something that this animal, I really want to buy this animal. Shirley had been keeping an eye on her and just watching her, and she said, I really think I'm going to try to buy her. Well, every time she tried to put her offer up, the people that were selling just said, no way, No way. We're gonna sell her as a breed horse. Well, you know what? It just really got bad for this horse. Even though Shirley tried to keep an eye on her, she went through a winter that was really, really bad. And she said, you know, I can't give up on this horse. Somehow or another, I know I've got to find a way to buy this horse. Well, the situation turned into a very unique one. She found that someone that had purchased this horse ended up not coming to get her. So Shirley said, I'm just going to do this one more time. And so she made another offer, and by golly, they said, oh, we've got to get rid of this horse. Nobody seems to want her. You've got her. Well, as it happened, there was someone else that had really been interested, but she had been able to close the deal, and they weren't able to come in and outbid her. Well, if she hadn't done that, this horse would have ended up being put into what they call a feedlot to fatten them up before they're slaughtered. So she saved this horse, who was considered a throwaway horse. She saved her and took her home, and you know what? After 3 months of being with Shirley and her other horses, nobody can recognize the former horse. It's just the way she was. She just doesn't exist anymore. She named the horse Copper. She said, this animal at 18 years of age is the horse of my dreams and almost completely restored to good health. She said her coat is shiny, her eyes are sparkling. And she said this horse was so exquisitely trained by someone. This horse had fabulous manners. She said she is strong. She has the heart of a lioness. And she outshines horses that are many times more her market value and loyalty and gentle spirit. She said, I can't understand how anyone would have parted with this wonderful animal, but she'll be my companion, my shiny penny, until the end. She's no longer anyone's throwaway horse. And this woman is located, Shirley is located in the state of Washington. And she said for over 40 years she's been involved with animals. And when they come into your life, they're there for a reason. So that's a story about a throwaway horse that I thought was just too good not to share with you. This is Donna Siebel. Give me a call if you'd like to chat. I'll be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. 877-876-5227 is the number if you're in the U.S. of A. If you're in Canada and you'd like to chat with me, 888-810-8322. I had someone asking me yesterday, Donna, what do we do if we want to talk to you? All you have to do is call in to one of these toll-free numbers, give me your first name or your initial, and I'll be happy to share with you my insights about yourself. And then you're welcome to ask me about anybody or anything that you like. Well, how about a little bit of trivia on food today? Are you aware that Betty Crocker doesn't exist? She's not a real person. In the 1940s, Betty Crocker was voted the second best-known woman in America, second only to Eleanor Roosevelt. And that's not too bad for someone that doesn't exist. And she never existed at all, but she was developed. She got her last name in honor of a former company director. The company added Betty because they thought recipes should come from a woman with a familiar and friendly name. And wow, as a marketing tool, didn't that take off? We still, I don't care what generation you're talking to, Betty Crocker? Yes, we're familiar with that name. How about the Jolly Green Giant? Well, he began his career as a scary-looking org wrapped in an animal skin. Well, it was an artist that decided to give him a gentler, kinder look that, of course, we green bean eaters everywhere continue to appreciate. And you know what? There is just another little bit of trivia, and I'm sure there's so many of you that are very much aware of this when it comes to food. Did you know that Fritos, and we're all aware of Fritos, means fried in Spanish? Fritos was named by an ice cream salesman named Elmer Doolin. Don't you just love names? Facts are so interesting. When he tasted tortilla chips for the first time in a Mexican restaurant, he loved them so much that he bought a tortilla factory from the owner. And the rest, as they say, is la historia. Yes, a little bit of history. Frito-Lay. That's the name of the company. And by the way, you know, I used to work for Frito-Lay. I worked for them in Westchester, California many years ago. What a wonderful company. It was just an incredibly fascinating environment to be in. Donna Siebel here, and if you'd like to give me a call, I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of insight. Give me a buzz in the U.S. at 877-876-5227 or 888-810-8322, and that's for those of you in Canada. Now, if you have a computer and you want to become more effective and efficient at using it, and I appreciate if you can do that. I'm not always also efficient at doing that myself. Well, there are so many ways that you can get different things done, and one is by printing postage you might need online at www.usps.gov, or you can locate a 24-hour automated postal center where you can get everything done anytime. Also, you have your Post-it digital software. If you never want to forget an appointment, you can create a Post-it, and when it's time to get busy, the alarm sounds and the Post-it pops up on your screen. And then if you want to get a copy of your birth certificate, need certain records, go to this website, vitalcheck.com, because you can get it from them. Select your state and the document, and the site places the order in just a matter of seconds. Your to-do list, well, you got another website you can go to. It's called tatalist.com. That's TTOMADDONNALIST.com. And you can create a virtual list of your chores or the rest of the family. The list can be private or shared, so everyone crosses everything off. And then if you want to fix any appliance, go to repairclinic.com. Repairclinic.com. Do you know they can answer questions on fixing just about anything around the house? And there's another good thing about it. It's free. Yes, it's free. So that's all that you need to know. You got some wonderful tips right there. It can save you a lot of time if you're one of these people who likes to be on the computer and use it more efficiently. This is Donna Siebel. We're going to take a break for a moment. We'll be back in just a little bit. And, well, tomorrow we're going to have a Best of Donna that's going to be on the air that I know you'll enjoy, and then I'll be letting you know about the people coming up next week. So don't you go away now. We'll be right back. Hi, this is Donna Siebel, and just a quick reminder, we've got a wonderful lineup of guests for you next week, which I know you will enjoy. John Weiser is going to be with us. We're going to be talking with him at the first of the week, Untapped Markets, fascinating business information. And then Timothy Bellavia will be speaking with Timothy in New York. He's a man that's dedicated his life to working with children, and I love the title of his material, We Are All the Same Inside. So we're going to be talking about kids on Tuesday. And then if you love dogs, maybe you're considering getting a puppy, maybe you've gotten an older dog, we're going to be talking about 1,000 best dog training secrets. Now, obviously, we're not going to be able to tell you all of them, but this is a wonderful book that you might want to have in your library if you would love to know how to work with dogs more effectively. And then Bob Seidensticker is going to be my guest. Future hype. Technology is something that makes you shudder at times, or you're curious, or you think the world's going too fast. All kinds of misconceptions. Bob's going to be sharing some information with us. Then Medical Misfit. Jolene Corbin, this is a woman that has walked a walk of experience that I don't think you're going to want to miss hearing her story. Then we've got the untold story of Al Pacino coming up. Oh, we've got so many wonderful things that are going to be here on the airwaves at bbsradio.com, and I look forward to being able to share it with you. Don't forget to tell your friends about the program, and we are archiving shows, so they'll be able to go in and listen at their leisure. And you go to bbsradio.com, you can find out all about it. Log in and join our listening family so that you can be a part of so much of the wonderful programming that we have. I want to also share some information with you today. Malaria is a disease that has been the plague of humanity for I don't know how many centuries. And they've come up with some interesting information. The World Health Organization and a team of leading tropical disease specialists seem to be a little bit at odds over the dimensions of the problem with malaria. And it said that in the U.S. you have just as much a chance of contracting malaria as having a meteorite drop on your head. In other parts of the world, however, malaria is a scourge, and it is getting worse. And, of course, we all know that mosquitoes are the carriers of this, and they don't get sick, but we do because it's part of what's in their system. Now, the World Health Organization says the number of cases could be as high as 400 million. However, there is a gentleman that challenges that. His name is Bob Snow of the University of Oxford in England, and his colleagues say the number should be higher, that 515 million people are infected with the mosquito-borne parasite each year. And they base this assessment of theirs on, well more than 80 studies from around the world that have done house-by-house surveys of actual cases. You know, so often when we get something, we just say, well, I'll get over it. And in many parts of the world, that's what people do. We do it here. Why wouldn't they do it anywhere else? Because they don't have the doctors, or they just feel like it's something they've just got to work through. And malaria is bad stuff. It really, really is very, very hard on people, and it kills so many. Now, both of these groups, the World Health Organization and also Bob Snow and his colleagues, say that the bulk of infections are in Africa. However, they're saying, on the part of Snow and his colleagues, that the number outside of Africa is 200% higher than the World Health Organization found. They say that the World Health Organization numbers are lower because the agency relies on data from clinics. And they say it is a gross underestimate of the burden of malaria, especially in countries like India and Bangladesh, where not all that many people go to the clinics. There's a fair amount, but they've got good-sized populations. Now, they say the precise figures, well, they're impossible to find, and that makes sense to me. It would be very difficult to be absolutely precise with this because lots of times people get sick, they just stay home. They don't go to a clinic. They're not going to check in with a doctor. They just say, well, I'll get over it, and they do. So they both agree, both of these groups, however, that the situation is very bad, and it is preventable. Now, this information I found quite interesting because I know there are people that go camping, do all kinds of things, and they don't consider how they need to be thoughtful about the environment of mosquitoes. Even up in Alaska, I mean, you have what I call the 777s of the mosquito family that travel up there, and you also have them where they're called the no-see-ums, and it's not fun. This isn't a joke because they really can make your life miserable. So they say that they have what they call insecticide-treated bed nets. They're willing to give them to households that will protect young children, reducing their susceptibility by 50% and their overall chances of dying by 16 to 17%. Now, this particular net costs only $4, and they say the people who do get the disease can be treated with inexpensive combination drug therapies. To a large extent, whether it's 400 million cases or 600 million cases, it doesn't matter. For a disease, it is to a large extent preventable and certainly eminently treatable. It should be unacceptable for the burden to be that great. And here are some of the numbers. And the new estimate of people infected with malaria is 298 million to 659 million. In Africa, it's 216 to 374 million. In Southeast Asia, 66 to 224 million, 9 to 26 million in the Western Pacific, in the Americas, 2 to 8 million, Eastern Mediterranean, 5 to 25 million, in Europe, 4 to 9 million. So there's just all of this, and so much of it, mosquitoes love environments where water is standing and where water gets stagnant because they just love to lay their eggs there. So it's very important if you are in a warm climate area, make sure you have areas that where there's standing water there. Don't let it get stagnant. Pour it out. Make sure that you keep the environment free of those breeding arenas. Well, my goodness, we're out of time. This is Donna Sebo. It has been absolutely delightful to be with you today. Thank you so much for listening. And don't forget, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Tomorrow there will be a Best of Donna, and then we'll be back live again on Monday with you here at bbsradio.com. God bless, have a great day, and enjoy the blessings that you have that are so abundant in your life. Talk to you later. Bye for now.